the election system in the United States is essentially on trial, and today can be considered to be akin to arguments before a jury. You, ladies and gentlemen, are the jury. But we have a question which hasn't really been answered. I'm going to defend the existing system, but do I take the burden of the defense? Which is to say, do I only need to demonstrate a reasonable doubt as to the prosecution's allegation of misuse, fraud, and basic malfeasance? Or do I need to take the prosecution? Do I need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the system is secure despite occasional errors? I'm going to take the greater burden on myself, and I will try and demonstrate that the system is secure. I will try not to simply point out points of security, but rather try and suggest that the entire system, from start to finish, is largely immune from wide-scale manipulation or wide-scale fraud that would mean that the result does not represent the will of the voters. The question I'm going to answer in the affirmative is this: does America's election system accurately record and report the results of legally cast ballots by legally eligible voters in an election? The answer is indubitably yes. Now, you might be surprised to hear that in light of things that you've heard over the last few months and last few years, and I am not claiming that the system is flawless. We have thousands of jurisdictions that administer elections in the United States. Each has tens to hundreds of precincts underneath it. There are so many moving parts in this system that it would be amazing if it were utterly and completely flawless. What I am saying is that there's no systemic flaw in any jurisdiction in the country that gives rise to a reasonable doubt that the system in that jurisdiction works. All elections in the United States have three parts, and I'm going to go through each in turn. The first is the registration of voters. The second is the method of casting of the ballots. And the third is the method of counting of the ballots. None are immune from problems. All are substantially secure. First, let's talk about registration. I'm going to presume, given that you have paid a significant amount of money to either join a politically inclined organization and or spend additional money to come to this event, that you are all registered to vote, which means you're inclined to know what registration to vote means. Congratulations. One quarter of your fellow citizens are not. They choose to be so disengaged from the American political system that they don't even bother to put their names on the register that allows them to cast a vote. However, the question about registration is not whether your registration is accurately recorded. We all know that it is. The question is whether or not there are people who are not legally eligible to vote who are also on the rolls. And the question then is, if there are, do those people cast votes in significant numbers that they actually determine the outcome of the elections? Now, one could imagine a registration system that would be better than the one we have. When I was young, rolls were purged every year. After every two-year election, if you didn't vote in the general election or the primary election, you were removed. You had to register in person. That's now been replaced with a decentralized system where you're registered at the motor vehicle department, you register yourself online, and you're not removed unless you haven't voted in two consecutive federal elections. But despite that, and despite obvious problems with respect to the maintenance of the rolls, there's little to no evidence that there's a substantial number of people who are not legally eligible to vote who are actually casting ballots. Now, there are two types of people who are usually brought up when people try and argue that there are. Those are people who are non-citizens, whether here legally or non-legally, and those are people who are inactive or deceased or in otherwise non-voters who suddenly come to life when fraudsters engage this inactive registration. With respect to the illegal voter, there's virtually no example of significant numbers of illegal people casting ballots. How do we know this? We know this because we can actually know where those people live. we have something called the Citizens Voter Aged Population Numbers that are produced each year by the Census Bureau by looking at the American Community Survey, which surveys thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people nationwide each year and asks questions about citizenship. If the Trump administration had been smart, they wouldn't have fought to get the citizenship question on the short form of the law of the census. They would have mandated that the reapportionment data include the five-year average, which is accurate at any sort of census level that is required for redistricting. But I digress. The citizens voter aged voter population may not be 100% accurate. In other words, there might be people who are non-citizens who lie to the survey takers. But an amazing number are actually tell the truth, so that we have a pretty clear examples of areas that have low numbers of citizens and areas that have high numbers of citizens. What we see is that the number of votes cast in areas with low numbers of citizens are in fact substantially lower, not marginally lower, not a little bit lower, dramatically lower. Let me give you the example of Nevada. Nevada has four congressional districts. The congressional district that has the highest number of known non-citizen adults is the one, and I'm talking about the lines that were in effect in 2020, not the newly redistricted lines, that basically occupies downtown Las Vegas and some of the near-in suburbs. In 2020, 223,213 people cast ballots in that congressional district. The largest number of votes was cast in the neighboring district that represents the highest educated area and among the least number of non-citizen voters, 417,252. Now, consider that Nevada was decided by less than 3 percentage points of the vote, which means it was decided by less than 30,000 votes. If there were fraudsters who were engaging in a massive number of illegal votes, you've got 200,000 votes sitting in District 1 that you could have brought up and registered and voted to ensure that there was never any doubt that your side was going to win the election. But that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen because illegal people are, by and large, not voting. There's not a conspiracy to bring them to the polls. The same thing happens in other places. Consider California 21. California 21 in 2020 was a marginal district. David Valadao, a former congressman, had lost in the 2018 wave, and he's trying to regain his seat from T.J. Cox. This happens to be an area in the Central Valley with a large number of Latino farm workers. One can guess how many of those are actually citizens. I'll leave it to you. But the fact is, 172,000 people voted for president in that district. Mr. Valadao won his seat back, defeating Mr. Cox, by a narrow, narrow margin. Compare this to another marginal seat in an area well to the south, the area of Orange County and where Orange County meets Diamond Bar in Los Angeles and a bit of San Bernardino County on the side. This is the district that Young Kim regained for Republicans in 2020 after losing in 2018. 351,000 votes were cast there. Consider the district slightly to the south that Katie Porter represents, a highly educated area including Newport Beach and Irvine. 418,000 votes were cast there. Consider the district where my father lives, District 4, the one then represented by Tom McClintock, which is basically the retirement areas and the exurbs of Sacramento. 428,000 people were voting there. All you needed was an extra 3,000 votes in that illegal dominated district in David Valadao's area, and you would have had T.J. Cox come back. Massive incentive, even though California is a blue state, to turn out people, falsely register them, and bring them to the polls. Didn't happen because it doesn't happen in large numbers. Now let's consider the question of inactive and dead voters. There are too many people who are on the rolls who shouldn't be. There should be more regular purging of the rolls and updating of the rolls. But what we do not see is inactive voters suddenly becoming active when incentives kick in. If there was wide-scale ability to manipulate and fraudulently control the system, that's the sort of thing you would see. The sort of person who a fraudster would identify no longer lives in the area or is deceased, clearly is somebody who is not going to contest your ability to cast their vote for them. You then register that person for a mail ballot, and voila, you've cast an illegal vote. Doesn't happen. People who are inactive on the rolls stay inactive on the rolls. People who are dead, by and large, don't vote, or have people vote for them. And there is the occasional example of the person who voted for his dead mother, or the person who cast a ballot as, you know, that she was alive when the ballot was requested and died when the ballot was actually delivered. There's actually a case like that. But again, these are rare. These are anecdotes. They're anecdata. They don't swing elections. Now, the balloting. There are four types of ballots that are generally used in the United States. There's mail-in ballots that are obtained by without having an excuse. There's, in many states, early in-person voting, where you go to one of many centralized locations and cast a vote in person in the same manner as if you were doing it on election day. There's the election day in-person voting. And then there's provisional voting. And provisional voting is something that was added nationwide as a part of the Help America Vote Act in 2002 after what happened in Florida. And what it, so I now know I've used 11 minutes of my 20. What that means is that, say you go to a precinct, and you're not on the rolls there, but you say, hey, I'm legally able to vote. And this can be for a number of reasons. Could be that your registration wasn't updated in time, or it could be as, hey, I've cast a provisional ballot. I went to my old or my new precinct rather than my old precinct because I had moved, and or my old precinct rather than my new precinct, I forget which one I went to. I was on the rolls, but I was in the wrong place, so I cast a provisional ballot. And that is basically you cast a ballot as if you were casting it by mail, and you sign it, and they put it off to the side, and then after the election, they check whether or not you're validly registered and whether your vote should be counted or not. There's no reason to think that any of these are being manipulated. Mail-in ballots have a lot of gaping holes. They can be manipulated, and it's one reason why we should rein in the use of them, encourage people to vote in person early, and also add security measures as countries that use widespread mail-in voting like Australia does. But there's no demonstration that these mail votes are actually being used to cast illegal votes. When mail-in voting is introduced, as it was, say, in Pennsylvania, and as it has been in many other states, you do not see sudden increases in turnout or unusual shifts in margins, which is the sort that you would expect if people are going to start using this new method to create fraudulent votes. You don't see it over time, either. It's not like they're smart enough to not do it in year one, but they do it in year six. Any place that has instituted widespread mail-in voting has the same sort of voting patterns as they had, as those areas had before, once you account for various types of voting changes in the electorate and demographic changes of the area. Ohio, Florida, and North Carolina have large mail voting without excuse populations. They've been increasing that number over the last 20 years. They have not shifted to the left. In fact, Ohio and Florida have shifted to the right. Mail-in balloting can be manipulated, but it is not being manipulated. We can usually see when mail fraud does occur because of patterns that are violated. And that's an example that we observed in one case where mail fraud did happen. There was a special election in North Carolina. It was a long district that included Charlotte suburbs and went out into the rural areas. And what people after the fact noticed was that, hey, candidate X was winning the absentee ballots just about everywhere except in this one county where candidate Y won. But there's no reason to think that candidate Y would do better there. Candidate Y didn't do any better during the in-person vote. What's the excuse? The excuse was there was an entrepreneur who was running around collecting mail ballots and marking them up for people. He was committing mail fraud. You identify the possibility for fraud by identifying discrepancies and patterns that suggest it might have occurred. You will not find those discrepancies when you look at mail-in balloting throughout the United States. You will not find discrepancies in the 2020 election between high mail vote counties and their prior behavior and low mail vote counties and their prior behavior. Early in-person voting, again, it's the same as election day voting. So if your state requires voter ID, you have to present it. If your state doesn't require voter ID, you don't have to present it. So the real question with both those is, does the existence of voter identification deter large numbers of impersonal fraud, which is that is there significant numbers without voter identification of people who are impersonating people in person? Studies have shown over the last few years that there's virtually no change in turnout when states implement strict voter ID standards. Now, the good news is that you use these studies to say, hey, guess what, Democrats? 74% of Americans want these, and there's no voter suppression that happens. Isn't that great? The flip side is it also shows there wasn't any fraud being deterred. Voter impersonation may happen again in the individual. There may be a case where somebody does impersonate somebody. It does not happen in the mass. Then you have the final system, provisional voting. Provisional voting is something that is rigorously checked. People look at those signatures and those requirements, and a large number of them are rejected. It's not a case where afterwards the electoral agencies will simply wave a magic wand and say, oh, you said you could vote, therefore you must. You can take a look at the returns yourself, because these are all data that are announced. You can go take a look, even in highly Democratic areas or highly Republican areas. Many people are rejected when they vote provisionally, and many others, like I was found to be on the rolls, just in the wrong place, or had some other disability. So there's no reason to think that we have systemic manipulation of the actual balloting. So then that brings us to the final source, counting. Are the nefarious malfeasance manipulating the counting process? So ballots are counted differently in different areas, but generally they fall into a couple of categories. First of all, machines of one sort or another do the counting, and they have to. The United States is the only country in the world that basically votes on somewhere between 10 and 50 or more issues simultaneously. Everywhere else in the world, when you go to the ballot box, you're either asked to have one question before you, whether or not you elect the member of parliament, or like in Sweden, which voted last Sunday, they had three different elections simultaneously, and they were given three different ballots to hand out. That means that everywhere else in the world, people count by hand, because you literally fill out a piece of paper, or in the case of Sweden, you take a piece of paper representing your party, and you stick it in an envelope and seal it, and then it's counted by hand. We can't do that. If we wanted to, we could. We could have people fill out a separate ballot for president, count it all by hand. We'd count that in one night, and then everything else would be left for tomorrow. But which is what happens in those other countries, is that they counted the parliament first, and then they count the regional, and then they count, because there's only so many people that you can have counting things by hand. But so machines have to count. So then the question is, can we trust the machines that count? And the answer is, yes, we can. Why can we do that? First of all, machines are checked beforehand by members of both parties. Machine accuracy is checked in every jurisdiction in the country in a publicly available, you can go on your county or city's, whichever jurisdiction enables your website, and find out when are the machines going to be checked publicly before the election. It's public information. They are checked, and every party can go in and check whether or not X machine counts the ballots accurately. So before the election, they are checked. They are then checked after the election. And most importantly, we have something called a canvas. On election night, what you're getting is the quick unofficial total. We then have a period, which differs from state to state, but is usually 2 to 4 weeks, called the canvas period. And what that does is allow them to check for errors. It also allows them to do the crucial hand check. That what you do in these places is you select randomly precincts, and you count those ballots by hand for a certain number of races. And then you see, did they match the machine count? If they didn't, you've got a problem. But they usually, if not always, do. Let me give you an example that I researched that I know of specifically. Maricopa County in 2020, which you've probably heard, and that's where Phoenix is. It's the county that's alleged to have had many problems in the 2020 election. Maricopa's system of canvas works like this. A few days after the election, a representative of each of the three major parties, three because the Libertarian Party is a registered party, sends representatives to the county recorder, and each representative randomly selects two precincts. So then they sit and they count, they look at four different races, and they see, does the printed ballot differ from the machine count? And the answer in Maricopa was not on a single race, it differed by a single vote. But for there to be a conspiracy, Democrats, Republicans, and Libertarians in Phoenix would all have to have conspired as to which six precincts in cahoots with the recorder's office to know exactly which ones had not been manipulated in difference to the ones that were manipulated. I leave it to you to decide whether or not that happened or whether or not, in fact, the machines counted things fairly. This happens in every jurisdiction because the system is secure and is made to ensure security. Anecdotes of misdeeds do not mean that any of those anecdotes actually caused an issue. It is extremely difficult to tamper with machines, and as I noted, it'll be caught after the fact. And adding votes, that is to say ballot stuffing, is extremely difficult. And if it did happen, it would be caught because of the patterns that I mentioned. If you're going to stuff ballot boxes in one jurisdiction but not elsewhere, you're going to create a pattern. Now, let me give you an example. I studied Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is almost a perfect place to do this because in 2016, they had no excuse absentee balloting and no in-person voting. So it was the Trump gold standard. You know, a couple people voting because they were sick or out of town, everyone else shows up on election day. 2020, they had no excuse mail voting. What did I find? I found that there was no relationship between at a county level, and you can see this, I wrote this up in the Washington Post, just Google Henry Olson, Pennsylvania, 2020 election, and you'll find it. It was January of this year, I believe. First of all, what you find is that there's no relationship between the number of mail votes cast in a county and the Biden vote share, or more importantly, the shift in 2020 from 2016. You can have 70% mail ballots, you can have 17% mail ballots. The county doesn't shift towards the Democrats. You would expect to see that if mail votes were being manipulated to cast fraudulent ballots. You don't. Nor do you see turnout increases. And this is particularly important because of the allegations that Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, Allegheny County, stuffed the ballot boxes. In fact, Philadelphia, what I do to look at turnout is you compare the number of votes in each election to the number of citizen voting age population in the jurisdiction. And what you find is that Philadelphia had the second lowest increase of any of the counties. The only county that was lower was a county with Penn State, where presumably the students weren't voting because the campus wasn't open. You're stuffing a ballot, and Trump got more votes in 2020. So they didn't produce more votes overall, and Trump got more of them. If you're stuffing the ballot box, that's pretty incompetent. Allegheny was in the bottom. It only increased by like 5.7%, and was on the bottom scale of the turnout increases. But more interestingly, what I found was that when you plot the 67 counties in Pennsylvania and their turnout, you come up with a bell curve. Bell curve is exactly what you would expect if the turnout by county is randomly distributed without account for other factors. There wasn't manipulation of the system in the Keystone State. So in conclusion, I'd like to say no system is perfect. We had a recount in New York's 22nd Congressional District where their overseeing judge basically found incredible incompetence in one county, people who just didn't follow the law, not in favor of one candidate or another. These people were just incompetent on the margin. If it wasn't a simply cast ballot, they didn't know what to do with it. But by and large, from the registration to the casting to the counting, our system is secure. We can and should make it better, but you should be assured that in the absence of one of these cases, one of these examples of unusual activity that's not just anecdotes, but is borne out by large-scale data or large-scale activity, you can be secure that whether your candidate won or lost, the result actually represented the will of the voters in the jurisdiction that you were voting in.